Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the explosive revelation in Newsweek from new research, which has found that the case against Senator Al Franken was largely manufactured by right-wing operatives and then amplified by bot networks and orchestrated and disseminated by the right-wing echo chamber in the media. Nina Burley, the national politics correspondent at Newsweek, joins us to discuss her latest article at Newsweek, How an Alt-Right Bot Network Took Down Al Franken. We will trace the role of Trump's dirty trickster Roger Stone and the right-wing media network surrounding the alleged victim, the Hooters pinup model Leanne Tweeden, along with the Japanese bots. We will also look into how the Democrats folded, thinking Roy Moore would be elected to the Senate and that they'd need to take the moral high ground by sacrificing Senator Franken, while in the rush to judgment, not investigating who the women who came forward accusing Franken were and whether they were for real and their stories based in truth. Then we'll get an update on the Mueller investigation following today's announcement of a guilty plea from a former attorney at an international law firm charged with lying to federal agents about work he had done for Paul Manafort on behalf of Putin's puppet in Ukraine, Yanukovych. Anders Aslan, a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University, who served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia and Ukraine, joins us to discuss the ties between Manafort, Rick Gates, and the lawyer Alex van der Zwaan, who is the son-in-law of a powerful oligarch and co-owner of Russia's Alpha Bank. Then finally, we will speak with a former editor of the New York Times, Dulcie Limebach, the founder of Pass Blue that covers the United Nations, for which she writes and edits. We will discuss the address today to the UN Security Council by the Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas that was followed by a snarky rebuke from the U.S. representative to the UN, Nikki Haley, who castigated the Palestinian leader, reminding him that moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem was a done deal, even though Abbas had left the chamber before she made her speech. And joining us now is Nina Burley, who's a national politics correspondent at Newsweek. Her latest book is The Fatal Gift of Beauty, The Trials of Amanda Knox, which was a New York Times bestseller. And her latest article at Newsweek is How an Alt-Right Bot Network Took Down Al Franken. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nina Burley.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us. And we, of course, are very familiar with Russian bots as a result of the indictment coming down from the special prosecutor, Robert Mueller, and even today we're learning from the New York Times about Russian bots being arrayed to exacerbate social divisions in this country following the Florida school shooting. But I had no idea that there were Japanese bots as well being used in Americans' politics, this time not by the Japanese so much attacking us as the Russians apparently have been doing. But as you write, white nationalist provocateurs, a pair of fake news sites, an army of Twitter bots and other cyber tricks helped derail Democratic Senator Al Franken last year. And this is the research that you have brought forth. So let's get to it. How did they do this?
Well, I got wind of it because there's an organization called Unhack the Vote. And they're a group of tech IT guys who work at major companies who are involved in looking at things that have been going on with voter fraud and voter suppression in places like Pennsylvania. And one of them had come across this sort of a, what they regarded as something more than accidental, circumstantial evidence that after the day that Roger Stone tweeted that Al Franken's time in the barrel is coming, I'm paraphrasing, that was the day before or 2 days before Leanne Tweeden, who is, I believe, out there in California on the radio sometimes, was going to come forward with that photograph that started off the whole response to Al Franken's and the Al Franken is a groper meme. So he predicted it 2 days before, or a day before, and on that same day, a fake news site was created in Japan. A domain was created called realusa.site. And then Leanne Tweeden came out with her photograph. And, you know, the horses went, they were off to the races, and more women came out, also originally from the right, claiming that he had put his hand on them and when they were together and photographs and so on. And you can read all of those allegations. I think that they all have not been checked out fully, but that started off. And they discovered that 5 days later, another fake news site was set up called VoteUS.me. And they were basically picking up and spewing out anti-Franken headlines, and they were being picked up by like the Daily Caller and also other sort of well-known conservative alt-right figures and online, and then further disseminated by what they identified as a botnet, which is a group of fake Twitter accounts. All of them, they looked deeply into them, and all of them were had been created originally by Russian or Japanese, or they had been followed first by one Russian or one Japanese follower, and they all had between 30 and 60 followers. And normally, they tweet stuff about celebrities or, you know, sports scores or something, but they were suddenly mobilized to disseminate these anti-Franken bits that were being picked up by VoteUS.me and RealUSA.site, these little sort of fake news sites. And it appears that this is not sort of an accidental aggregation. This was a deliberate effort to use bots and fake news to assist in the taking down of Al Franken. It's not clear who was behind it, but it cost money. It cost money to set up. It cost money to write the algorithms for these sites to be able to pick out the Al Franken material, and they were running pro-Roy Moore material at the same time. But the timing of the creation of these things right after Roger Stone, who's been banned from Twitter, by the way, so he's not involved in any kind of conversation about this, the timing of it is very suggestive of a deliberate kind of operation.
And again,
we don't know who's paid for it, and there's no evidence that we don't know who put the money up for it.
And again, I'm speaking with Nina Burley, who's the national politics correspondent at Newsweek. Her latest book is The Fatal Gift of Beauty, The Trials of Amanda Knox, which was a New York Times bestseller. And her latest article at Newsweek is How an Alt-Right Bot Network Took Down Al Franken. So when you talk about Roger Stone, of course, you have to point out to the audience that Roger Stone is an opposition research whiz who's been a longtime friend of Donald Trump's, and has, after all, when he said Al Franken's time in the barrel was coming up, he said exactly the same thing about Podesta before the WikiLeaks data dump.
The DNC hack, exactly.
Yeah, so he said it's Podesta's time in the barrel. So that gives that warning a lot of credibility, for sure.
He likes barrels.
But
yeah, he's a black ops guy who goes all the way back to Nixon,
right?
The Nixon years. And he's been a Republican. He was in a lobby firm with Manafort, with right. The indicted Paul Manafort for a while. And he was a Trump advisor. He's been a Trump advisor for a long time, and he is, you know, he still talks to him, I would assume. But I don't think that this is a Russian operation. It doesn't look like there were Russian. We don't know, because they're anonymous. The guy who started it is Japanese. The guy who set up the domains is a Japanese tech guy, but there's no evidence that the Russians are involved in this, but who knows?
Well, but if you go back to when it was first revealed by this model and Hooters, she's a former Hooters pinup girl, Leanne Tweeden. She, of course, KABC is a complete right-wing talk radio propaganda outlet, not unlike Fox News. And
Don't the Mercers own it? Don't the Mercers have some involvement? Somebody told me that.
Right. I'm not sure about whether they have. I think ABC probably, which is owned by Disney, but perhaps they do. But there's no question that from the very beginning it looked suspect because it was a USO tour, and that's what USO tours are about. You know, you go back to Bob Hope with all those scantily clad women, actresses, et cetera, models prancing around, you know, exciting a bunch of horny GIs. I mean, so...
Right. Well, look, I mean, if your listeners care to find out who she is, all they have to Google is her name and images, and up will come countless modeling pictures of her in lingerie or in thongs, sprawled over cars, you know, she did Lad Mag kind of cover pictures, and, you know, she has spent her career really using her body and her female body to sell products and to, you know, using it in a way that is commercial. And there is a giant difference between an organic Me Too movement where you had millions of women coming forward organically online, spontaneously telling their stories, and this person who's somehow has a photograph that Roger Stone hears about. I mean, this is what I suspect happens. If somebody says, hey, she's got him. She's got him dead to rights. And he sees the photograph and he works with her until the moment is right. And they decide to open to let it come forward. And then, you know, there were more women. And my understanding is that those women have not been vetted. Some of them have completely disappeared. Their stories were not vetted. But the Democrats, you know, because they thought Roy Moore, with his pedophile past, was going to win. And remember, he was going to win. There were, you know, he was doing pretty well. And had he won and entered the Senate, they would have had the moral high ground because they would have been able to say, look, you've got a pedophile in there. We just got rid of our groper, Al Franken.
Right.
And if they hadn't done that, they wouldn't have been able to take the moral high ground. I mean, you can kind of see the political calculation there, but happened.
But you can also see the political calculation on the Republican side of why they wanted to knock this guy off. He, after all, had smoked out Jeff Sessions to get him on the record effectively lying about his connections to the Russians. He was extremely effective in the confirmation hearings for Betsy DeVos and a lot of these appointees to the Trump cabinet. And by the way,
he was the ranking minority judiciary committee, and he has power. He had power.
Sure.
And they threw away a powerful position and a powerful person in that. And I, you know, I think that this was an operation that was, you know, that Roger Stone and other people got involved in. And did they put up money for a cyber op, as minimal as it was compared to the Russian operation? I don't know, but that's what this looks like. It looks like an attempt to influence, swarm the internet, swarm Twitter with these allegations, make sure that they reached all corners of the internet, right, and drowned out other voices.
Well, I think the connection between Roger Stone and Leanne Tweeden and the people at KABC, all these right-wing shock jock types, the connection is that Leanne Tweeden's father's a retired Air Force colonel who's involved in all kinds of right-wing politics. So he may well have been the connection. But there's no question that, to my mind, that from day one, that it seemed like a hit job. And, of course, she came across as being, you know, an innocent babe in the woods, and all those women on The View gave her the benefit of the doubt. And she was nice to Al Franken, and she came across as being the injured party. So it was a very clever hit job that they did. And frankly, Kirsten Gillibrand falling for it doesn't do her well in terms of her, you know, running for president, frankly.
No, and I mean, you see the story that I wrote is getting, there's some pushback from some Democratic operatives online right now who are upset, I think, because Gillibrand, this story has elicited a lot of online anger and you know, abuse of Gillibrand, and it comes at a time when Gillibrand is under attack for her NRA connections. because of her upstate New York district. She's an NRA, she's pro-gun. And so that simultaneously, these two things happening, and I think are they're troublesome for her, and her people are not happy about it, because she has aspirations, and she, you know, she's one of the female leaders in the Senate who probably has her eye on higher office. So, you know, the taking down of Al Franken, and the taking down of Al Franken, if the taking down can be proven to have been something that the right wing worked on and plotted out, makes her look a little bit less heroic, I think.
Right. Well, I'd like to get into how the right-wing activists got involved with these bots, because Chemtrails Kelly, or at least that's what Ms. McConnell referred to her as, she was one of Stephen Bannon's candidates. She's actually running for the U.S. Senate in Arizona, and she was one of the people who latched on to these bots and disseminated it through her network. So how did the alt-right get involved here?
Well, I think, look, after the 2016 election, any time there is an advance in the use of technology by political strategists, any time a successful advance is made, and whether it was Obama in 2008 or Trump in 2016, those methods are studied and copied and used. And I have talked to Republican operatives who work for Trump who say, well, I said, what's the next thing? You know, you guys use Facebook, you use their bots. And one of them said to me, very high-level digital op guy for Trump, said, in 2020 and going forward, you're going to see a lot more bots. That's the future because of social media. And so it's not just the alt-right getting into bots. The blue state people are doing it too, or they soon will be.
Right. Well, that's the curse of the internet, just, though.
Absolutely.
All you have to do to fix this outrage, and I don't think anybody will do it, is to stop this anonymity that people hide behind their handles, you know, their Twitter handles. So,
well, I mean, not just in Twitter world, in
everything.
Citizens United, you've got hiding behind handles, right?
Right.
I mean, that's what Citizens United did. You've got dark money.
Right.
So everybody's hiding. You got dark money hiding, and then you've got anonymous Twitter stuff.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, the Twitter and Facebook, and we could talk about this forever, Twitter, you know, the bots were originally created to sell stuff. Right? They're commercial. It's a commercial operation. Just sell more stuff. You get some bots and you say, you know, have them say, oh, yeah, my widget was great. I'm so glad I bought that from John down the
right.
street.
Right. They're automatic. They're also called zombies. They're multipliers.
Right.
And they usually hack into passive computers in vast office buildings and have them multiply the effect. And that's, of course...
Well, you know more about it than I do, but that actually, my sources on this, they did mention that they think that was happening as well. That
right.
there are these force multipliers of computers that they've taken over.
Right, right. So, you know, this goes back, of course, to... In fact, there's a very good piece in Wired magazine about this, about how Jared Kushner, who ran their digital operation for the Trump campaign and was in league with Cambridge Analytica, which is Mercer's company that Stephen Bannon's on the board, it looks like they were the ones who buffaloed Zuckerberg into believing, they created this canard that Facebook had a liberal bias because they realized that two-thirds of Americans got their news from Facebook. So they came up with this canard that there was a liberal bias with Facebook, and instead of looking into it, Zuckerberg was rolled. Apparently, Zuckerberg is under the spell, or certainly the influence, of Rupert Murdoch, of all people. So they got rid of
his tentacles are far and wide.
I know, it's extraordinary. And apparently he panicked at the very suggestion that there may be a liberal bias in the news curation on Facebook, and then immediately got rid of all the human curators and brought in the algorithms, which the Cambridge Analytica and Trump and Jared Kushner and company were ready to game using the Russian multipliers. That's the Russian angle. They were simply the multipliers. So that's the story that eventually, I mean, I recommend the Wired investigation into it. It's quite comprehensive.
Yeah, I mean, the tech press is on top of this, and I just think nobody there seems to have any kind of solution for
it. Right.
I guess the only solution is caveat emptor if you're on social media.
Right. Well, but you know, this is a terrible thing that if it's true, and I suspect it is very true, that they did a hit job on a successful hit job on Al Franken. Because he was a threat to the GOP. And
absolutely. There's no doubt that. And someday somebody's going to go back and uncover this with these eight women, and it's going to be a whole different story.
Right. But
it's too bad.
Right. And here you have Trump calling for due process. Well, where was the due process when it came to Al Franken, you know? It's unbelievable.
Well, and you know, you have the president in office with 16 accusers and multiple women that he's paid off.
Right.
And has absolute impunity.
Right. Well, let's stay in touch, Nina Burley, and I hope you do a follow-up. And
I might.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, all right. You take care.
Thank you for your work. And again, I've been speaking with Nina Burley, who's the national politics correspondent at Newsweek. Her latest book is The Fatal Gift of Beauty, The Trials of Amanda Knox, which was a New York Times bestseller. And her latest article at Newsweek is How an Alt-Right Bot Network Took Down Al Franken. We're going to take a brief station break and back with an update on the Mueller investigation following today's announcement of a guilty plea from a former attorney at an international law firm charged with lying to federal agents about work he had done for Paul Manafort.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Anders Aslan, a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University, and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. He's a member of the Russian Academy of Natural Sciences and worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva, and Moscow, and serves as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia and Ukraine. His books include Russia's Capitalist Revolution, Why Market Reform Succeeded and Democracy Failed, and his latest book is Ukraine, What Went Wrong and How to Fix It. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anders Aslan.
Thank you.
And you were on the ground in Ukraine when Paul Manafort was there, and we've spoken about him in previous interviews, but now it turns out that this lawyer, Alex van der Zwaan, has pled guilty to the special counsel, Robert Mueller, and apparently he was doing work for Paul Manafort in a big international law firm in London, and that he had lied to federal agents about the work he was doing. So what do you know about what's going on here between Manafort, Alex van der Zwaan, and the work that he was doing? Why would he lie about, in other words?
Well, this law firm did a study of how crooked former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko was. And President Yanukovych had her sentenced to prison in quite an atrocious kangaroo court. And this U.S. law firm was doing this job for Manafort. I read the indictment today, and it's not clear how this Dutch lawyer has been lying, but he admits guilt, and he could be sentenced to 6 months in prison for this.
Well, but the Dutch lawyer happens to be the son-in-law of a Russian-Ukrainian oligarch, Zeman Khan, who is a co-owner of Alpha Bank, which, according to a lot of investigative journalists, played a role in the Trump-Russia affair, as much as we know. And he owns this bank along with the Mikhail Friedman and Peter Avin. These billionaires, of course, are suing a lot of people. They're suing Christopher Steele, and they're also suing Fusion GPS. So It sounds like this Dutch lawyer has got some powerful family connections.
Yeah, I don't know German Khan, but I know Michael Friedman and Peter Abend quite well. And these are simply people who love suing people. They are extremely litigious. I quite like them, I must admit. I don't know how important this connection with the Alpha Group is. I've read the Steele dossier very carefully, and the part that seems most tenuous to me is the connection with Alpha Bank. And it's also been rumored that there was some kind of money transferred through Alpha Bank to the Trump campaign, but I have not seen that, or it has not been verified. So that part I'm skeptical on. The Alpha Group has essentially moved out of Russia. All these three people you mentioned are today Israeli citizens. And Peter Abend is also a Latvian citizen. So they have moved out of Russia. They moved the companies out of Russia. They have most of their assets abroad. The companies, most of them are registered in Holland today. So I don't know how important that link is.
Right, but there were reports some time back that there was a server in Trump Tower being pinged by Alpha Bank. I don't know that anybody's got to the bottom of it. But it would seem, though, that what Mueller is doing is putting added pressure on Manafort, not the least of which is the fact that it looks like, according to the Los Angeles Times, Mueller has managed to flip Manafort's longtime partner, Rick Gates. So it looks as if the noose is tightening around Manafort.
Yeah, that I think is very much the case. And, well, I simply don't understand this Dutch lawyer, if it's only about this Timoshenko investigation, which, so to say, shows how crooked Manafort was. The law firm has already been forced to pay back $500,000 that they charged for this, and this is corrupt money that they took. I'm not sure if this is the key issue or if it's something else. I think the Rick Gates issue is more interesting, because my strong suspicion is that Paul Manafort, who's the most professional pollster you can think of, that he controlled Russian television coverage of Yanukovych. And in order to do so, you have to have very tight connections with Russian intelligence services. And Rick Gates should know about that.
So he's could be facing, if not the rest of his life in jail, at least another 10 years. So why do you think at this point he's hanging tough? Because it would seem that the writing's on the wall. In other words, Anders Aslan, do you think he could reach a point where it would be too late to make a deal with Mueller, that whatever he could offer them would be eclipsed by information from those below him ratting him out?
In many ways we can look upon it. This, that Manafort knows that he's so guilty that no plea bargain can save him, that he hopes for being loyal to Trump and therefore being given amnesty by Trump. And he could also ask for a deal with the Russians. He's a key person.
Right. So that certainly sounds to me like the more logical thing, that he's going to be a loyal soldier, fall on his sword, and hope to be pardoned by Trump.
Yeah. And Manafort is a man of no nerves whatsoever. He's absolute steel nerves. He is professional.
So, turning to the indictment that just came down from Mueller, what's your understanding, since you have extensive connections in Russia? We've seen Lavrov sort of dismiss it out of hand as blather, and obviously they're downplaying it. And a Russian senator actually asked the National Security Advisor, General McMaster, at the Munich Security Conference about, of all things, Russia and the United States cooperating on cyber issues, and that response from the National Security Advisor got him into trouble with Donald Trump because he basically said that the evidence presented by Mueller against the Russians was incontrovertible. Trump's behavior is completely impossible to figure out and completely counterintuitive in terms of what a normal American president would do when it became apparent that a foreign hostile power had been attacking the United States, not in the Pearl Harbor sense, but in an electronic warfare against the very foundation of American democracy. Trump himself has not stepped up. He's basically, it's all about him and not about America, which is extraordinary. But how's it playing in Moscow? Because my understanding is that Putin was absolutely freaked out when the Chapman group of spies were rolled up. And he is basically a former spy. And as far as I can tell, he runs Russia as though the whole country was, you know, a kind of extension of the KGB.
Yeah. The most strange thing now is that this massive anti-American propaganda that we have seen in Russia for months all of a sudden calmed down. That it appears as if this non-list that came out on the 29th of January was seen from the Moscow point of view as now we have made a deal. Now we are not going to attack them. So after having seen an absurd level of acrimony from the Russian side against the U.S., all of a sudden, for the last 2-3 weeks, it has been very civilized. And the question is what this is. And apart from what you mentioned, on the 7th of February, we saw that this private mercenary Wagner battalion marched on to U.S.-supported troops in Syria, Kurds and Sunni Syrian troops. And the U.S. Air Force bombed the hell out of them. And the question is how many people who were killed, 100 or 200. These were Russian mercenaries under the command of Prigozhin, who was named by Mueller in the indictment on Friday. One gets the impression that the Russians knew of this before, that they had decided, okay, the U.S. wants Prigozhin's head on a plate, let them have it, let us take out this Wagner battalion that he has in Syria, and sent them in to a pretty suicide mission. They came without air defense, without air support, without intelligence, and just marched on to the U.S.-supported troops. And this was completely in disagreement with the agreement with the U.S. on keeping troops apart. So the U.S. did what you do when an agreement has been broken. And what is really surprising is that the Russians have played it down. They said, oh, no, people were not killed. Well, apparently a few people were killed. They come up with afterwards perhaps 5, while 100 to 200 Russian mercenaries were killed. It looks as if Moscow, 2 weeks before this indictment of the troll factory in St. Petersburg that was also owned by this Prigozhin, who organized the mercenaries in the Wagner battalion in Syria, that they decided to cut him loose. He's not close to the intelligence people. So this is what we should really look into now. This is very strange. And the Russian attitude to the U.S. has completely changed. It seems as if Putin is saying, this is a country I can make deals with again.
So in other words, you think that basically Prigozhin's been sacrificed, that Putin can then, you know, cut loose from the underneath the shadow of interfering in the U.S. elections and basically somehow say what he's been saying all along, that maybe some patriotic Russians got involved in this, but we never did it. I mean, is that his strategy? Because I don't think that's going to work.
It was something very strange and interesting is going on. This is a hypothesis rather than a firm thesis. And we simply need to see what is it. And the big surprise here was that the last week of January, the three top heads of the Russian intelligence agencies, FSB, GRU, and SVR, domestic intelligence, foreign intelligence, and military intelligence, were in the U.S. for the first time. All three have been sanctioned by the U.S. for a long time, and they were clearly invited by at least the head of the CIA, Michael Pompeo, Dan Coats, the director of National Intelligence, met with them also. We have no idea what they really talked about. It's said that it was in counterintelligence. I don't believe that for a moment. I think that counterterrorism, but what it must have been about was Syria. And this was the week before the so-called Kremlin list was supposed to be published. It was published, and it was completely different from what was expected. And I think that was what the deal was about, something about the list and something about Syria. So this is what we would really like to know, but the U.S. authorities are not telling us anything about it.
And this would all be in the context of the fact that Trump himself has not acted on the sanctions, right? That's another part
indeed
of
it. Indeed.
Yeah. Well, look.
So
this,
it might be that he made a deal with the Russians that we don't know of as yet. It might be something very different.
Well, I hope we can stay in touch because this is fascinating, and clearly you're onto something. And I thank you for joining us here today, Anders Usland.
Thank you very much. Always nice to talk to you, Anders.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Anders Usland, who's a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. He's a member of the Russian Academy of Natural Sciences, and he worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva, and Moscow, and serves as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia and Ukraine. His books include Russia's Capitalist Revolution, Why Market Reform Succeeded and Democracy Failed, and his latest book is Ukraine, What Went Wrong and How to Fix It. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the snarky rebuke from the U.S. representative to the U.N., Nikki Haley, who castigated the Palestinian leader even though he had left the chamber before she made her speech. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Dulcie Limebach, the founder of Pass Blue, for which she edits and writes, which covers primarily the United Nations, West Africa, peacekeeping operations, and women's issues. Previously, she was an editor for the Coalition for the UN Convention Against Corruption, was the publications director of the United Nations Association of the USA, and was an editor at the New York Times for more than 20 years. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dulcie Limebach.
Hi.
So today, before there was an unusual session of the Security Council, at the United Nations, where Palestinian leader, addressed the Security Council, and then he was followed. His address was followed by Nikki Haley, the U.S. Representative, but he walked out prior to her address. And the takeaway line that people are quoting from Nikki Haley's speech is that I will not shut up. But in general, her speech seemed to be castigating him and the Palestinians for not showing up, as opposed to not shutting up. So what is your sense of what happened there today? The issue, of course, is the U.S. recognition of Jerusalem, which is a non-starter for the Palestinians. But what I get from what Nikki Haley is saying is that's a done deal. You're just going to have to stomach it, and we need to talk.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty much what happened in the gist of the meeting. It was the council's regular meeting on the Palestinian question, which can, of course, can go off into all sorts of tangents. But basically, Abbas left the meeting for a meet and greet that was already scheduled within the UN building. And whether it was timed to start when Nikki Haley was going to speak is, you know, of course, no one will be able to confirm that. But yes, he did leave. Nikki Haley often leaves a council meeting as people are speaking, so it's not, Abbas is not the only person to do so, but the symbolism was heavy. Nikki Haley, yeah, she talked about extending an olive branch to the Palestinian people, saying there's the path of negotiation and compromise. That path remains open to the Palestinian leadership if it is only courageous enough to take it. And then she did say the United States knows the Palestinian leadership was very unhappy with the decision to move our embassy to Jerusalem. You don't have to like that decision, she said. You don't have to praise it. You don't even have to accept it. But know this, that decision will not change. So on that note, then she reverted back to the two paths the Palestinians have. You can choose to denounce the United States, to reject the U.S. role in peace talks, and pursue punitive measures against Israel, or you can choose to put aside your anger about the location of our embassy. So it was a short speech by her, but basically the embassy decision is a done deal. It's not on the table of the negotiations. Whatever negotiations there are. Behind her was sitting Jared Kushner and Jason Greenblatt from the White House. I asked Jared Kushner when he left the council session whether there was an actual peace deal in the making, and he laughed and he said, oh yeah. And then I said, well, when will it be announced? And he said, oh, when the time's right. So the whole possibility of peace talks seemed completely, well, even more up in the air. And the Palestinian delegation said that because there was no reference to a two-state solution in Nikki Haley's speech, that possibility is now over. So that was the message, the takeaway from the Palestinian delegation.
But in terms of the U.S. delegation, when Nikki Haley made those comments that you just related to us, Dulcie, she did gesture towards Jason Greenblatt, the White House senior advisor,
right,
and Jared Kushner, saying that our negotiators are sitting right behind me, ready to talk, but we will not chase after you. The choice, Mr.
Right.
President, is yours. Of course, she's talking to somebody that's not there.
Not in the room.
Yeah.
So, well, the Palestinian ambassador to the UN was in the room, was sitting in the seat.
Right, right.
So, yes, she did designate a gesture to Kushner and Greenblatt behind her. That's true. And she did say that, Abbas is not in the room.
Well, so what is going on here? In the broadest sense, there are hints that there is a deal in the works,
right,
and that perhaps the U.S. can get some leverage out of the Israelis having made this massive concession of moving their embassy to Jerusalem. I don't know, you know, when you have people like Jason Greenblatt and Jared Kushner, their pro-Israel credentials are over the moon. I mean, Kushner gave up his bedroom to Netanyahu every time he visited his parents. They're close friends. So you couldn't have more ardent supporters of Israel in aboard Team Trump, including those that support the settlements. So is there any truth to this rumor that maybe the U.S. will actually exercise some leverage, having been so slavishly pro-Israel, they can swing back the other direction and at least get some concessions out of Netanyahu?
Well, I imagine that the Trump White House, given that they proclaim to be great deal makers, will use their leverage in one way or another. Nobody knows. We tried to ask a lot of ambassadors. The media tried to ask ambassadors as they left the meeting what the peace deal looked like, when and if there is one, when it will be announced. And the only inkling we got was from the Russian ambassador, who said half in jest that, quote, something is cooking. So that was really the extent of it. Whether there's actually something soon to be announced, all I can say is what Kushner said, which is, when the time is right. So you may find out sooner than me.
So what was the tone? I mean, when you asked Jared Kushner about this peace deal that is rumored to be in the works, and when he sort of said, oh, yeah, sure. From what I'm getting, and you were there, what kind of body language, what kind of tone to his voice? I know
that was pretty interesting, because I just happened to be walking down the hallway and he emerged with his entourage. Nikki Haley was behind him. And so I turned my head, and there he was. And I said, is there a peace deal in the making? Is there going to be one announced? And he smiled. I would call it, close to a smirk, touched my arm and said, oh, yeah. And the tone was definitely a little off-putting. I had to wonder about the sincerity.
Well,
but, it was an awkward moment because, suddenly he was being asked by a journalist this question.
Yeah, he doesn't make himself accessible to the press.
No. So, I don't know whether this was how he generally handles tough questions or whether he was trying to just be charming in his own particular way without, being offensive. I don't know.
Well, you could have asked him, how come you haven't gotten a security clearance? Right?
Oh, I had many more questions, believe me, that the security officials were descending on me.
Right. Well, but that is an interesting question, which is, why is it that he hasn't been given a security clearance? And apparently there's going to be some clarity on that, I believe, on Wednesday or Thursday, where the White House Chief of Staff, General Kelly, is going to be making some kind of announcement on the fact that there are about 130 people serving on the staff of the White House who don't have permanent security clearances. So that is a huge question in itself. It arose because of Rob Porter. But in trying to look into that, there's rumors about Jared Kushner being too close to the Chinese ambassador. Apparently, the FBI counterintelligence chief did interview him and warned him about Jared Kushner and Ivanka's relationship with Wendy Deng, the former wife of Rupert Murdoch, suggesting somehow she's a Chinese agent, which apparently is what Rupert Murdoch runs around telling anybody who wants to listen. Of course, he's mad as hell because she had an affair with his protege, Tony Blair, which broke up the marriage. So I'm not sure he's exactly an unimpeachable source on that. But the other rumor that one hears is that the intelligence community doesn't want to give Jared Kushner a clearance because he's too close to the Israelis. Have you heard that?
No, I haven't. No. I haven't been following the Kushner trail all that closely. I'm mostly focused here on Nikki Haley and the UN.
Well, then let's go back to that subject. And how does the rest of the Security Council relate to that? Because it comes across as sort of arrogant, somewhat bullying, somewhat condescending. There's no question that there's an asymmetry between the power of the Israelis, who hold all the cards, and the weakness and disarray of the Palestinians.
Yeah, so your question is, how does the council deal with this asymmetry?
How do they deal with it? I'm saying that it comes across to me as sort of unnecessarily arrogant, given that we seem to have unconditional support for Israel, and Israel holds all the cards. So I don't know why you beat up on the victim.
On the victim being the Palestinians?
Yeah.
Nikki Haley is pushing her campaign to stop what she calls anti-Israel bias in the UN. So this is where she's coming from. She's been very vocal about the, quote, anti-Israel bias in the UN. She's not the first person to bring this up, and this has been a problem for Israel and the U.S. for decades. And the source of it has not really been plundered very well. One diplomat said to me that the more that Haley pushes Israel, in the face of other UN members, the more they resist opening up to Israel. So whether she's actually doing Israel any good is a question. Israel is running for a Security Council seat this year, along with Germany and Belgium. There are two seats open for the Western European and other group. So that could be, an interesting race as it gets closer to the culmination, with Germany, Israel, and Belgium, three countries vying for two seats. And the rest of the Security Council is very pro-Palestinian. That has actually cemented since the Trump move regarding Jerusalem in December. And that includes France and the UK, surprisingly. The UK always sides with the U.S. on all decisions, virtually all decisions. So the UK's disagreement over the U.S. decision was palpable, was very visible, was very vocal.
So it's been a while, of course, since the General Assembly of the United Nations voted to label Zionism as racism, and that was not one of their finest moments. But surely there's a distinction between anti-Israel bias and those that disapprove of Israel's treatment of the Palestinians.
Well, I think that it's all sort of sewn up in the same problem and the continued illegal settlements. I think that's really a tremendous bone of contention, and that came up today, and it will continue to come up. And, the U.S. skirts that issue. Nikki Haley did not talk about the illegal settlements in her speech. So it's a problem, and that may be the leverage that the U.S. may have over Israel in whatever peace deal or peace proposal they're operating with.
But prior to Nikki Haley's statement, of course, when Mohammed Abbas addressed the U.N. Security Council, he said, "We met with the President of the United States, Mr. Donald Trump, four times in 2017, and we have expressed our absolute readiness to reach an historic peace agreement. Yet this administration has not clarified its position. Is it for the two-state solution or the one-state solution?" So he made that pretty clear. So when he walks out, and then Nikki Haley more or less says that she's not going to shut up, and she's going to continue her criticism of Abbas, and that he should essentially accept things on the U.S. terms. So no mention of what went on in those four meetings with the President of the United States. I mean, there's got to be a record there, hasn't there?
Good point.
They weren't talking about the weather, were they?
No, that's a good point. And so now you're opening up a door, a very important door to, yeah, what was discussed. I will pursue that question with the delegations here, because obviously something was discussed, as you say, and I haven't seen any reports on it. And I was completely taken aback by Abbas saying that he's actually met with Trump four times in 2017. So that's a good point to raise, a very important point.
And just in closing, then, do you think, why was he there in the first place? Because it is unusual to address the, Security Council.
Kuwait is president of the Security Council this month. Kuwait is obviously an ally of the U.S., but it's also a Middle Eastern country that's close to the Palestinian people. So whether the Palestinians approached Kuwait on the idea of bringing Abbas to the meeting is unclear, but the Abbas's meeting was announced by Kuwait at the beginning of the month. So this obviously had been in the makings for a while. And whether, another country would have agreed to have Abbas speak at the Security Council is another question.
Right, but that does lead to look at the geopolitics of the region that is shifting in a curious way. Israel is almost a de facto ally now of Saudi Arabia and probably by extension Kuwait. These Sunni kingdoms are terrified of Iran. Israel's all talking about war with Iran and kicking them out of Syria. So you'd think that since these countries like Saudi Arabia and Kuwait want the Israelis to settle the Palestinian question so that they can work more openly and more cooperative with Israel, you'd think that would resonate with Israelis, but no indication so far that it does.
Right, and it's hard to gauge Israel's true relationship with the Saudis and then, by extension, the Kuwaitis. Mm-hmm. The Kuwaitis and other countries in the region were livid about the Jerusalem move, and I still believe they are still upset about it. Mm-hmm. As for Egypt, that's another story. But seems to me that a lot of the countries are still very upset about this because it does seem like a fait accompli.
Well, Dulcie Lineback, I thank you for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Dulcie Lineback, the founder of Pass Blue, for which she edits and writes. It covers primarily the United Nations, West Africa, peacekeeping operations, and women's issues. And previously, she was an editor for the Coalition for the UN Convention Against Corruption, was the publications director of the United Nations Association of the USA, and was an editor at the New York Times for more than 20 years. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.